That's all this noise. Would you kindly get off the stage? I'm in the middle of a concert.
A concert? Honey, you're gonna put the paint customers to sleep with all this jazz. You gotta get the new sound. Come on now, let's compromise. You give a little, I'll give a little. Come on, let's get together. That's it!
Let's get together, yeah, yeah, yeah. Why did you and I come on? Let's get together, what do you say? We could have a swinging time. Maybe.
Go to the mirror, boy. Go to the mirror, boy. I often wonder.
We're going to try something here. And by that I mean literally an episode about trying things. I was recently invited to take part in an international museum summit put together by the organization Museum Next. They usually put on conferences all around the globe, but in the pandemic era, like most things, everything pivoted to virtual. I was tasked with talking about tone and institutional voice and why they matter. Why and how a small museum in the middle of the country can have an impact on par with bigger institutions. Not wanting to just talk into a laptop camera for half an hour, we thought it might be fun to play with the format itself. I had just recently watched the original 1964 version of The Parent Trap while browsing around Disney Plus. To refresh your memory, the film features Haley Mills portraying a pair of twin sisters, separated and living with divorced parents, unaware of each other's existence. For some silly reason, that sparked something. What if I interview myself, I thought. So that's exactly what we did. We recorded a video of me, well, two of me, chatting on a couch in one of the larger galleries at Philbrook. I wanted the presentation itself to be an example of play and pushing the boundaries and seeing what you can really do with a little humor and a little creativity. Being that this is an audio format, the gag might lose a little steam, but the response was positive, and I wanted to share it with you, dear listeners. A look behind the scenes. So enjoy this conversation between me and, well, me. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and so am I. And this is Museum Confidential. Well, thanks for taking some time to chat. I've got a million questions, as you can see, but I've done my best to narrow it down. So we'll just go ahead and dive in. How important is tone to a museum? Well, I mean, you know, it would be easy to overstate it, but tone to me is really everything. I think when you're trying to define yourself as an institution specifically, it's important to understand what people think of you already. You know, there's that famous phrase that perception is reality, and it's very true, even though it's quite a cliche. I think you can do all the new policies you want, you can put anything in place, but if you don't have an understanding of how people think of your institution writ large and your community, then you certainly won't understand how to start changing that if that's what you want to do. So, you know, being here, for example, in this museum that's been around for 80 plus years, there's a lot of things already baked into the cake. So if we wanted to be redefining what Philbrook is, we really have to kind of start at that ground level. And for us, looking externally, it's all about tone and how to start with that. So we're calling this presentation Stuffy Old Museum. That's a title you suggested. You want to talk about what's that all about? So I've been here since 2009. And when I came on, it was kind of early era of social media, and that was kind of the Wild West. You could do whatever you wanted, but we also didn't know how to begin the journey of turning the ocean liner around and thinking about Philbrick in a new way. We knew that we were always going to be perceived as this giant 72-room mansion, which we certainly are, and we're in a wealthy neighborhood, all those things that, you know, we can't change and we don't want to change, but that certainly speaks to how people think about us. And so why not play off of that? So we, over the last, you know, 12-plus years, occasionally we'll find something that's an image, then we'll juxtapose it with that language. So it could be someone, you know, playing a classic 80s arcade game in the museum, or it could be someone just hula-hooping out in the garden or whatever you want. And then we'll put the words stuffy old museum so you kind of see that contrast and then let the images and let what we're doing really speak for itself. It's one thing to know that you need a new tone. It's another thing to try and actually implement it. Where do you start? I think the best way to start is to understand, well, what your tone currently is, right? If you want to go in the direction of something more humorous, slightly irreverent, whatever you want it to be, what's your baseline? When we started this project all those years ago, the idea was to try to bring a more 21st century flair to what we were doing. Because if you look at the first, say, decade of this century, our communication style wasn't too dissimilar from the few decades leading up to it. We wanted to start thinking about that in a different way. And the easiest way that I could think of and our team could think of was starting to kind of not take ourselves too seriously, bringing more humor into the mix, and maybe lightening things up some. And so, that's not applicable for every space. Not everywhere has the need or even the capability of doing them. If you're at a museum, for example, that deals with a very serious subject matter, you certainly don't want to be seen as taking that for granted or making fun of it or whatever. But here we had a lot of opportunities to do that. So we kind of started at that ground level saying, you know, how can we take what we're doing, add some humor, add some levity, maybe push the envelope just a little bit and see where we can incrementally change from there. So let's talk about consistency. I hear about it a lot, but how important is it really? Super important, and it's not just consistency in social media. Of course, you know, whatever you're doing on that space, we know we need to be reaching people on a day-to-day, sometimes hour-to-hour basis. Being someone who, you know, if you go to our Instagram page and we hadn't updated it in 3 days, then why would you come back tomorrow, assuming that we would? So, but not just that, you know, once you're dealing with tone, which is something that is not solely in the sphere of communications, that's curatorial, that's development, that's fundraising, all those different things, that tone needs to kind of be across the board and be consistent within your institution. That takes a lot of buy-in from, you know, all the different departments, making sure that they understand that a letter going out to someone asking them for money, not all the time, but if you can have that consistency of voice where you feel like the Philbrick tone of voice has this certain identifying quality to it, and you can see that in the signage that's in the museums, you can see it in the interpretive materials, you can see that all across the board, then slowly it's that kind of wide net that catches all the different audiences that you want to catch.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Ubiquitous Gaze. What is that, you ask? You know that creepy painting with the eyes that follow you all around the room, no matter where you go, no matter where you stand? It is always looking right at you. Well, in the art game, that is called Ubiquitous Gaze. This technique gained popularity after first showing up in the art world around the 14th century when a certain artist and architect introduced the concept of linear perspective. Linear perspective being the sort of, well, bad habit there. You get us going on the art history stuff and we really can't stop. Anyway, ubiquitous gaze. You'll know it when you see it.
So you guys do all kinds of wild and wacky things. When you're wanting to be a little bit more edgy or humorous, where is that line? How do you know what the boundaries are, really? Well, it's hard to say for sure. And we've certainly been lucky in the fact that, as I mentioned, having been doing this since the what I call the Wild West period of social media, where, you know, in that 2009, 10, 11 period, you could kind of try stuff. And, you know, and our audiences were pretty small still at that time, so we could see what worked and what didn't. But, you know, you just kind of have to have an eye. And one of the things that's important for us is when we're looking at new media and social media and things like that, we've always thought that it's not a tech sector. It's an editorial sector, you know. I was brought in, for example, with more of a writing and editorial background. I'm not an IT guy, and I don't know much about tech, but it's like, how do you craft a voice and a tone? And so understanding the place and also knowing that it will evolve, you know, the things we can do and say now are not the same things that we might do in 2015 and even the few years before that. You know, so as society changes, as we kind of slowly migrate our audience to where we want them to be, you can kind of try and do more things. But a lot of times you just know it when you see it. And we always say, if you have a question about it in your head, you should probably run it up the flagpole and see what everybody else thinks too, just to make sure and get another pair of eyes on it. Let's talk about audiences for a second. You've talked before about the differences in the different platforms and the demographics that are tied to those. Is that still a concern, understanding that a little bit more? Talk about that some. Yeah, I think that early on, we didn't understand exactly that Facebook was one audience and Instagram was another audience and Twitter was kind of this hybrid audience and TikTok and vice versa. But as we've gone on, and sometimes through, getting back to the previous question, sometimes through the things that don't work or things that maybe ruffle some feathers on occasion, that's where you see and you start to understand the tonal differences in those platforms. And so, yeah, sometimes we will do something that's like, this is going to be a huge hit on Instagram. It's not going to work on Facebook, or even just a few words. We might change the way we describe something or whatever that is. But the more you can understand those audiences and those demographics that are tied to those platforms, it's just going to lead to a much broader strategy in your communications. So as you said, you work in the communications department. There's a bunch of different departments in every museum. Let's talk about buy-in. You can be out there doing a lot of things on your own, but unless you have buy-in from all the different departments, it's not going to work. How do you think about that from your end when you're trying to pull something off like this? Well, I mentioned that a little bit before, but specifically, it's really about making people understand what you're doing. We have, over the years, had different forms of this, but we'll have a thing, for example, called Creative Review, which is a meeting where we just let other department heads come into a meeting, and we talk about print projects that we're doing or a social media schedule or all the different things so that people understand. It's not just siloed off into a space where the social media people or the communications team are just over there doing their own thing. And so the more people feel like they're part of the process of creating that content, and that could be someone in our learning team who's doing some kids program out in the gardens, and you know, and also you're going to get more ideas that way. The more people that you have at the table, you're just going to understand your institution on a more 360 degree level. And so I don't see any downside to that, but it's really about, you know, we talk so much about communication in terms of talking out towards our audience, but a huge part of it is the team here talking more internally and understanding what you're doing, and then those things communicate with each other. Here's an easy one. How do you know if what you're doing is actually relevant? You don't ever know for sure. And the one word I like to use a lot is buzz. You know, relevance is tricky, but buzz is something that I kind of understand, you know. And no matter how many likes or comments or shares something might get, those data points are important, but there's just a different feeling when you've done something that's gone viral or people are talking to you about it and you understand that. Kind of to flip it a little bit, I understand more when something isn't relevant than when it is. I pay much more attention to those quiet moments when you kind of feel this unease of like, we're kind of not in the conversation right now. Maybe we need to look to do something that's going to get us back on the radar of our audience, because people are barraged with so much content and so much coming at them all the time. It can be exhausting to understand that you have to kind of be renewing people's interest in what you're doing all the time. But it's also, if you look at it this way, it's a challenge and an opportunity to try to keep being creative and doing new things. So yeah, I kind of see it from that opposite angle of, you know when you're not relevant. And if you can focus on those moments and flip it then the rest will kind of take care of itself. We've talked about all this fun stuff that you guys have done, and if people don't know, they should certainly look on the social media platforms that the museum has out there. But we're all for fun and lighthearted content, but in this age of COVID-19 and post-George Floyd, how do you handle that balance between wanting to have things that tie back to your institutional values, but also wanting to maintain your audience in terms of that lighthearted, fun tone? Well, we have a real-world example of this, which is just this past spring here in Tulsa, where we are. We commemorated the centennial of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, which was obviously a major event here, and then nationally, you know, it was kind of the thing everyone in the country was talking about for those couple of weeks. And we did programs and exhibitions around that topic. And yeah, it's an interesting question where, you know, we always talk about wanting to be fun and engaging and relevant. There's not anything particularly fun or, you know, lighthearted about any of that content. It's pretty heavy stuff. But then it comes to its balance, you know. When you're posting and you're talking about things like that, well, then you know that, you know, the other two-thirds of the time, maybe you need to kind of give your audience a moment of respite, whether that's talking about, hey, come to the gardens, you know, because our community at that point was, you know, it's not a celebration. That was not a celebration. It was a commemoration, which is a quite different thing. We're paying tribute to these people who lost their lives, this moment in American history. But it's also, you know, it's a lot to take. And so saying, hey, we have these beautiful gardens, come hang out here. You can find respite. You can find a place of R&R. That's where we balance it out. You know, we don't balance it with silly, you know, kind of stuff. So yeah, ultimately it comes down to that balance and finding that way into that. Because we also don't want to not be in that conversation. We want to be part of that community conversation, but just doing it the right way. Last year, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok banned posts from several Vienna art museums that contained nude imagery. In protest, the museums moved their artwork to the adults-only website, OnlyFans. For those unfamiliar with OnlyFans, it's a site that allows individuals to monetize their own adult content. The website itself has become quite polarizing, with some seeing it as a bastion for free expression, and others as a tool for exploitation. The protest effort kickstarted a movement now known as Vienna Laid Bare. Works by provocative artists like Egon Schiele can now be seen freely via the 18 and over subscription service. According to the website of the Vienna Tourist Board, quote, Vienna and its art institutions are among the casualties of this new wave of prudishness, with nude statues and famous artworks blacklisted under social media guidelines and repeat offenders even finding their accounts temporarily suspended. That's why we decided to put the capital's world-famous, quote, explicit artworks on OnlyFans, end quote.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org